Good morning. The hour of 8:15 having arrived, we are calling the meeting of the House Fraud and Agency Fraud Prevention and Agency Oversight Committee to order. It looks like we have a quorum, so I would like to ask for approval of the February 24th minutes. Representative Rarick, do you approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So Representative Rarick moves the approval of the February 24th minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. All right. Today we would like to welcome to the committee the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Matt Verlich, and anyone his staff you would like to bring with you. He is coming to present about how DEED handles grants management oversight. We very much look forward to your testimony. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Verlich, and I serve as Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and I'm accompanied by a couple of colleagues who are also prepared to answer questions and assist as we go.
Great. So we'll have you start your presentation, and I know, members, you have in your packet the slides available, a very thick slide packet, so we look forward to that. But members, we welcome questions along the way because sometimes it's hard to remember things till the end, so feel free to signal if you want to ask a question. Thank you, Commissioner. Please proceed.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So just to give you a high level of the grant-making function at DEED, and hopefully this will be a helpful addition to, I know, the conversations you've had already with the legislative auditor, with OGM, with DHS. We, of course, at DEED are focused on our mission of empowering the growth of the Minnesota economy for everyone, and we do that through a wide variety of programs, but when it comes to grants in particular, as you can see, we have programs that involve nonprofits as the recipients, as well as businesses, 30 that are competitive grant programs totaling $163 million, and again, that time frame, as you can see, is FY23 to 24. And then direct appropriations in the number of 136, valued at a larger sum, $268 million. And then beyond those, we also administer dozens of other economic and community development programs focused on businesses, cities, counties, et cetera, such as broadband infrastructure. So this slide about our responsibility at DEED is partly about setting the right tone, and as you can see in the first bullet, we take this role very seriously as good stewards of the precious taxpayer dollars that are entrusted to us. And you could look at this as sort of just a throwaway line, but it's a very important one because it's about setting the right tone at the top and striking the appropriate balance between, as you can see in the next bullet, ensuring that we are efficiently delivering funds to designated recipients to achieve the ends that the legislature has told us to achieve, but while also ensuring that stringent financial oversight to protect taxpayer funds from fraud and mismanagement. And I recall in watching the initial hearing you had with Legislative Auditor Randall, there was a key moment. Someone asked about Representative Schultz, it might have been you actually, my representative, I should add, in central Minnesota, about in what circumstances are agencies doing things in a very effective way. And Auditor Randall noted that it's important to have both those goals in mind of both efficient delivery, but also a certain amount of skepticism and taking that oversight function seriously. And then I think the other answer from the deputy was that it's best, especially in larger agencies, if you have some separation of duties and you have a finance department that is interacting very closely with your programmatic operation, and I think we have that at DEED. And then finally, you can see when we identify challenges from an organization that's operating in good faith, we do look to work with them to bring them into compliance with our policies. Because, and this is somewhat similar to the discussion I think you had with DHS about compliance issues versus fraud issues, if it's simply a matter of compliance with an organization that's trying to do the right thing but might have just gotten it wrong, we want to work with them in a collaborative way to help get those services moving and doing it the right way.
Thank you. If you wouldn't mind, Representative Rarick has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you had mentioned the legislative auditor, and when you started your presentation, it made me think about the conversation that we, the committee, had with the legislative auditor, and she had a very strong opinion about legislatively directed grants, and that on the front end, I will say it. I know that we, the legislature, do not do our due diligence. We don't look at 990s. We don't look at audited financials. We don't make sure that there's an IRS determination letter. We don't make sure that they are registered with the Secretary of State or the Attorney General. We, and Indeed, I know, has, you can see from your first slide,
yeah,
136 directed appropriations from the legislature, and it is, $268 million, which is a significant amount of money. And in the last biennium, we had $1.1 billion of legislatively directed funds to nonprofits. And again, those processes did not happen. Nobody looked at the salaries of those CEOs executive directors or CFOs or, the top people. Nobody looked at that, even though it's clearly spelled out on the 990. So my question to you is, since we know the legislature isn't doing that, is there anything that you do at Deed to look at some of those documents after we've done a legislatively directed grant?
Madam Chair,
Representative. Yes, Commissioner.
Thank you. Yes, we do require that even recipients that are named in legislation still have to go through the same pre-award risk assessment as other grantees that we may have selected through a competitive process. So the 990s, the audit of financial statements, the IRS, 501c3 status, those are all required, but only as a matter of getting the grant contract in place, not as a matter of identifying the recipients. And I would say I don't know if we are officially on record as favoring one approach or the other. I will say that we have high confidence in the systematic way that we go about conducting competitive grant processes, because we can take a holistic look to see, do we have good geographic distribution? As a Central Minnesotan, as a Greater Minnesota Commissioner, I am always looking to see, are we trying to reach all parts of the state, including the metro as well, of course. And we have community reviewers that also participate in our processes to help give additional insight on what amounts to a good portfolio of recipients. And when you have legislatively directed grants, I don't know necessarily that there is that holistic look. And I would add, too, that some of my perspective that I bring to this might be similar to yours, in that I've come into this job having previously been an executive director at a nonprofit, at a foundation based in Little Falls. And I guess back to the notion, too, about the tone at the top and taking the oversight function seriously, I want to say from the nonprofit side, the vast majority of nonprofits have the view that we did, which is we better get this right, because this is a very important responsibility that we're being given to deploy taxpayer dollars. And you hope to do it well and then have a good reputation that allows you to do more of that work in the future.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate that you worked as an executive director at a nonprofit. I have as well worked, I don't know, probably collectively about 20 years, either in churches or nonprofits, and have put my share of 990s together, or have been on the staff side doing audits and being that compliance person on the inside. So I appreciate that, and I do know that when we do. So I've served on a lot of different committees, and one of them I've served was an oversight committee for Deed and Dolly and all of that. So we had the workforce development funds. But something that we do at the legislature very strategically is we do try to say, geographic fairness, and, we try to put out all those parameters. And my concern is when the legislature, and we've got 201 of us, so we've got 201 different priorities and when we just say, well, we're just going to send this $1.1 billion worth of funds to these nonprofits, none of that happens because we don't sit down in a committee room and say, well, we need to make sure that Greater Minnesota and the Metro and, you know, this diverse group and, you know, are all accounted for in this $1.1 billion. We don't do that. We don't have that kind of function here at the legislature. I wish we did. I wish that we did what you were just describing, is looking at 3 years worth of 990s, the audited financials, making sure you have an IRS determination letter, making sure that they are actually registered here in the state of Minnesota as a proper nonprofit. I wish all those things were vetted and done here at the legislature when we do these directed appropriations, but it simply is not. The other thing that we don't look at, and I don't know if you look at, so here's my last question, Madam Chair, but okay. We also do not look at how much money these top executives of these nonprofits are making. And as I've been preparing and looking at, you know, for years now, but more specifically for this committee, I'm seeing salaried people that far exceed what the governor makes. And the reason that's important, as you know, being a commissioner, any local government, whether it be county, city, township, if they want to pay somebody in that local government more than the governor, for years and decades and decades, they had to come to the legislature, to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, and petition and basically request of the legislature to do so. And yet when I'm looking at 990s, I see salaries that far exceed the governor on nearly everyone. There are very few that don't make $140,000, $150,000 or more, and multiple people. So these are all concerns I think that we have on this committee. And I'm sure you don't even look at that because that's not something that we legislatively direct you to do. But I appreciate what you do, and I'm glad that you do look at those things after we do a directed appropriation. So I thank you for that. But Madam Chair, there's so much to talk about when we talk about nonprofits. But I'm glad that they are actually doing some due diligence, because we've had other state agencies here that do not. So thank you, Madam Chair, for that time.
Yes, thank you. And Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just wanted to correct something on the record. And let me say, and the Chair knows very much, I'm a big fan of shifting to competitive grants much more. And actually, Representative Rarick, I look forward to talking to you. Madam Chair, you and I have talked about that, so I think this is something we can share a lot. But I did want to just correct that last year, the funds that went to DEED, the legislative directed ones, before the committee passed those out, they did review the most recent 990s, proof of their 501c3 status, audited financial statements, registration with the Secretary of State or Attorney General, several other things. Again, that's not to take away, I would like to shift competitive grants, but I do want to say the direct appropriations, there really was a review of a number of the documents that were referenced. Thanks, I'm looking forward to getting to hear the rest of the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Chair Pinto, just to clarify, who reviewed that? That was done in the committee?
Yeah, my understanding, Madam Chair, is that the committee had all those documents in front of them before the appropriations went out. I don't know exactly some of those details, but I do know that there's some real frustration among some of the organizations because it takes a long time for the funds to get out, because in addition to the legislature identifying them, there is still the process that we put in place these last couple of years, that even when an organization is identified, it's not like then immediately a check goes out to that organization. Then we require the agencies to go through a series of steps as well.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate this. And I just also, to the question of sort of shifting from legislatively appropriated grants, which we heard, we spent a lot of time talking about grants in this in the last 4 weeks. In 2021, I sat on the Workforce Committee in the House. There was a proposal that was both the former DEED commissioner plus chair, Knorr at the time, I believe it passed off the House floor, but was rejected in conference by the Republican Senate, to shift our DEED grants to a competitive model. So I think that there have been in the past, I know, and probably before that was just when I came into the legislature, efforts to actually say and address that problem that the OLA recommended. I will note that sitting in committee in the last 4 weeks, there have been a lot of legislatively appropriated grants proposed by both sides of the aisle, but we have mostly just been hearing them proposed by GOPers, and some pushback in public safety, in workforce, in others. So I think if there is bipartisan support for moving forward with the proposal that I think has been around for a long time to shift grants from direct appropriations from the legislature to competitive grants. I believe you will find a willing partner on this side of the aisle, and in fact, Democrats have been the one who championed that in the House in the past.
Thank you, Representative Greenman.
To that point.
Representative Rarick.
Just really quickly to that point. So, Representative Pinto, thank you for saying that. I think that's unique to that committee. I've served on a lot of different committees for 13 years, and we have never had any of those documents presented to the committee. So I just want to be clear that that might have been a very new thing, because I have served on the committee, and that did not happen, especially for workforce development funds. And legislators lovingly call it the legislator slush fund, which is a sad thing, but that's what it's been lovingly called for the last 13 years that I've been here. But in any case, that process that was done that you described is not pervasive across the legislature. It apparently was unique to just that slice, and I just wanted to make that clear, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I just wanted to chime in, since we're having this robust conversation among ourselves here. My freshman term, I served on the Workforce Development Committee, and I was stunned, having just come out of the nonprofit world myself, that the people who came in asking for workforce development funds literally could not identify basic things that were supposedly in their 990s, and that really concerned me. And I'm glad to hear that, because I've not served on it since my freshman term. I'm glad to hear things are moving in the right direction. So, and I'm sure you're continuing to work on that. So please continue with your presentation, Commissioner.
Thank you. My favorite kind of hearing is when you all have a conversation.
We are not a shy group, Commissioner.
Great. So this slide touches on some of what you were just discussing. You'll see in the slides ahead that we show kind of a typical competitive grant process, but want to acknowledge in the second bullet there that because we have a wide variety of grant programs, the administration process may look slightly different due to the structure of the program as established in legislation. But to the discussion you just had, we do apply the same oversight and controls on both competitive grants and direct appropriations as part of the process of getting to a contract. So first, for competitive grants, we have to do a request for proposal. We develop that RFP based on what is in the law. And then once we have it, we post it on our external website for a minimum of 45 days. And then we try to get the word out through email blasts, and we encourage our interagency and external stakeholder partners to circulate the RFPs to their networks as well, because of course the first step in getting a good representative, highly competitive pool of applicants is making sure that the right people know about it. Next, the issue of conflict of interest. As you can see, state grant policy requires procedures be in place to prevent individual and organizational conflicts of interest. We have additional conflict of interest requirements at the operational level. For example, if at the time of contracting or if you're adding or changing any partners, DEED requires grantees to fill out a compensated partner information form. I'd ask grantees to disclose any actual potential or perceived conflicts of interest with any subgrantee, contractor, vendor, or trainer to be compensated. And we also require that grant reviewers certify they don't have a conflict of interest before they begin reviewing grants. And I can attest to this just on this very day. After this meeting, I have a couple other ones, and then the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board. And I know that part of the packet that comes out beforehand is, here's the agenda, here are all the applicants for the funds, and here's the form that you must check the box to indicate that based on this list of applicants, you don't have any affiliations that could constitute a conflict of interest. And there's a separate, I don't know if it's a separate form or a separate box that is checked whether you are DEED staff or if you are a non-governmental member of the MGSP board.
Commissioner, if I can interrupt you there, this issue of conflicts has been a continuing theme that the OLA has found in different agencies. And so when a conflict of interest form is filled out and a conflict exists, how do you handle that?
Well, I can't say that we have encountered many of them. I think the central principle is transparency. So awareness, disclosure, and recusal would be the main approach. If we identify that a conflict did exist after the fact that we somehow didn't know about, then you'd have to probably examine other remedies, whether there should be something to do with stopping further payments, et cetera. I wonder if my colleague, Deputy Commissioner Majors, if you would be okay with it, if I might invite him to add on that.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. Mark Majors, Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Development, indeed. Madam Chair, I would just add a point to the Commissioner's statement is that exactly what he did say around if we do see a conflict, but the recusal piece will happen, will definitely occur. And depending on the scenario, the individual may, if it's a voting scenario, may or may not actually leave the meeting all in itself. But there haven't, to my knowledge, been too many instances of that I know of, so.
Great, thank you. I just want a quick follow-up. So if a conflict is found prior to the grant being issued, the expectation is that people would recuse themselves from the decision?
Yes.
That's great, because that is not true across the board. We're finding that just acknowledging the conflict is where some agencies leave it. So the fact that you would require recusal, I think, is a good best practice. One second. And secondly, when you review, because I know you say you treat the legislatively named grants the same as you treat competitive grants. So do you, in fact, look at whether there are conflicts for legislatively named grants as well?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do look at that. We will take our teams will take the steps of actually even looking at the staffing and seeing if there's same name of individuals who may be the director versus also individuals providing the program services. And then we'll follow up and actually ask questions. Are you related? What's the relationship like? We'll look at if individuals are being paid or not paid. So there's some investigation that does go on after, even as we're going through the process of determining whether or not there is conflict or not.
Great, thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, clarify something. I think in this context, our language needs to be precise. But I believe what we heard the OLA when they're talking about conflicts of interest was actually talking about the paperwork being filled out. I don't believe I've ever heard them, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, say that there's actually a conflict of interest issue, that they are actually finding conflicts of interest that exist that have not been reported. But there's a paperwork issue, which leads to, again, when we're talking about the problem, when we're talking about the solutions, we should be really clear what the problem is. So we need to make sure that the paperwork gets done. But my understanding is that we're actually not talking about a conflicts of interest issue like we are seeing at the federal level, where people are getting billions of dollars of grants and then in government making decisions.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. I would note that because the paperwork is usually absent in these cases, that we just cannot verify whether a conflict exists, and that's why the OLA continues to raise that. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I think that when I've looked at your report in lead up to this meeting, this is the area that probably needs the most attention for the purposes of our discussion here. So, last week when we had DHS here, they have like basically an Office of Inspector General right within their agency with they have 400 employees doing this work. Certainly it doesn't appear like you are touching the same amount of money, but to what extent and can you go into detail in regards to who is poring over this information and try and be as specific as possible as to the extent to which your agency is diving in to these conflicts of interest and what. Just be very thorough in that process for us to understand, to make sure that there's nothing that we should address legislatively to fix that.
Well, maybe
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, I might answer at somewhat of a high level. I know you do want to go in more detail, and so I might look to my colleague again. And to answer the question of who does what exactly, part of the reason that Deputy Commissioner Mark Majors is here, he leads our Workforce Development Division, and it is the Employment and Training Programs unit within his that is primarily the one that does workforce development grant making, and they had, I think, 12 or 13 competitive grant programs they did in the last biennium. And so it is, I believe, as part of the pre-award risk assessment when, okay, you've made it through the selection process and been named as a potential grantee, but now to get to a contract, you have to provide us those financials, you have to provide us the 990, et cetera. in order to actually get to a contract and have the dollars start flowing. And that's also where you need to flag whether you have any affiliations or your organization has any affiliations that could constitute a conflict. On the, I guess, going back one step chronologically to the selection process, that's where you could also have conflicts. Now, for legislatively appropriated, legislatively named recipients, that's not an issue there because we're not reviewing. We're not deciding who is receiving it, but rather the legislature is. But when it comes to the competitive grant processes there, the reviewers need to be identifying if they have any affiliations that would cause them to not be objective in deciding who receives the funds. So, Deputy Commissioner, anything you'd add?
Sure, thanks. Thanks, Commissioner. Madam Chair, Representative. Yes. So, it's a very comprehensive approach to doing the selection through a competitive process and the who's doing what. Primarily, when an RFP is submitted, we have what we call grants coordinators, who are our program staff, and they will make go through and make sure, at least at a minimum, that the application meets the basic requirements to submit an RFP, request for proposal. At that point, as we kind of, once we get the actual application, they will, after that, they hand it off to individuals who will do the review of the actual RFP. And again, that may include individuals from community reviewers as well as staff, as well as other individuals who are skilled at looking at requests for proposals. At that same time, we have a team, which is our contracts team and our fiscal team, who are doing that pre-risk assessment work simultaneously. So you have the review of the application, but at the same time, you have the review of the fiscal paperwork. And then they will, that fiscal team and contracts team, will look at the 990s, will go through and make sure the agency is registered with the Secretary of State and so on and so forth. And then at that point, the program team, as well as fiscal team, will work with the director of the employment and training program to make determination about the awards at that point. So you have two different teams who are looking at the paperwork at the same time, and then they will come together and make an assessment. Way in the background, we have our fiscal office, which is separate from the employment and training team, which they are also working with at the same time on any other issues that may be arising determine if there are any issues. So you may have different parts of DEED working on a request for proposal program at the same time, but it's usually grant coordinator and then a contracts person who is looking at the paperwork, both on an RFP. It's a little complicated, but I hope I explained it well.
Thank you. Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner and Commissioner. I was surprised to hear the Commissioner say a moment ago that that there hasn't been many instances of conflicts of interest arising. And so I'm curious. I'm glad to hear that there's two different teams reviewing the information in the reports that are sent to you. But kind of looking at your process then, if there hasn't been issues around conflicts of interest, can you kind of share for us, is there any key takeaways that you have that we should be implementing in other areas of state government that has helped make your agency successful?
Well, Madam Chair?
Yes, Commissioner.
I would say on the frequency question, whether we see conflicts, part of it maybe relates to where I sit in the process. For a lot of the grant programs, I'm getting the final list of recommendations after they have been through lots of the community reviewers, and they are the ones, along with our own staff, who would have had to identify if they had any conflicts. But in an example like the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board, where I do get to be a voting member on the final list, there I see a lot of recusals. So I think the system is kind of working as intended. When people acknowledge that they have an issue, then they will simply step back either from the vote or from participating in the discussion. So in terms of what changes I would recommend, I guess I feel like that transparency approach is a good one. And if, as Representative Greenman has noted, that the paperwork has just been an issue. I guess it's partly a matter of having good systems in place to capture all the paperwork and then be able to pull it up if there is any question after the fact. And then it's not a one-and-done situation. So as we noted somewhere, oh yeah, on the same slide, a new conflict could arise based on a change in staffing. And so you need to refresh those periodically as well instead of just saying you've done it once and call it good.
Thank you, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you were talking about you were reviewing the 990s, the audited financials, and all the other documents. I'm just curious, like, when you say you're reviewing them and you're looking for maybe red flags or reasons to either grant or not grant, what exactly are you looking for?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I mean, at a very basic level, it is, do you have your nonprofit status? Because if you don't, then I don't think we can proceed with payments. And there have been cases where they may have lost it temporarily, and so we then pause payments, and then if they get it restored and everything else appears to be in order, then we can resume.
Thank you. Is that all, Representative? One follow-up. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I mean, that's just the IRS determination letter, and you can go on the IRS website and just see whether or not they are active or inactive, and there's a whole history there. But you said you reviewed audited financials and 990s, and I'm just curious as to what are you looking for in those that would be a determination, a determining factor moving forward?
Yeah, and, Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Sorry. Jumping in a little quickly. Thank you. So I believe we'll touch on this a little bit too in the subsequent slides, but one thing we do with the financials is not just do they exist, but are they reliable and have they been audited by a third party? And then we look at financial ratios, for example, current ratios, acid tests, et cetera, to ensure that those are in a healthy range. And I don't believe it's an automatic denial if you don't have them in the healthy range, but then it potentially can kick us up to classifying that grantee as higher risk, in which case we would then take some additional measures, which could be technical assistance working with them, or the deputy commissioner has arranged a number of instances with a small grantee and sort of a mentor, larger nonprofit that has more financial capacity to work with the smaller entity.
Thank you, Commissioner. Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you, and I apologize, I have to go to a legislative audit commission meeting that we have to be at, so. I just ask that you later, because I see it's later in your slides, talk about the outcomes, because we know that we have, billions of dollars in grants that are going out. It's scary. Some of these entities don't even have basic financial information, or their paperwork is out of whack. And it's wonderful that you're doing what you're doing on your end, and we need to do more and more of that. But it just goes to the point of how, if you have organizations that can't even get their own paperwork in order and are asking for public dollars, what kind of outcomes could it possibly they give us? I look at these nonprofits, these grantees, as vendors that are taking out, they are doing things that we ask them to do. If they can't even do basic things like have their nonprofit status up to date, they certainly can't provide services. So I hope that as this, as we try to tighten up everything, that we actually start looking at what outcomes are we getting for these dollars. Because I think we're going to find that we're not getting our money's worth for a lot of this. So thank you.
Commissioner, is there a later slide about there outcomes is, that you want to jump to while Vice Chair Anderson is still with us?
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, just yes. To respond, and I'm not quite sure which slide it is. So for sake of time, just share a few thoughts. One is that it's a threshold requirement that they have the paperwork in place before we can make the grant. But then your point is, if finances are a challenge, if financial management is a challenge, how can they actually deliver services well? And that's a fair question. But one thing that I observed from my time at a foundation where we were working with nonprofit grantees who existed to do good work in community was you often have leaders of nonprofits who are very passionate about homelessness, very passionate about nutrition, very passionate about veteran suicide prevention, and they know that work, maybe because they are a veteran, and they haven't got an MBA or they haven't got an accounting degree. And so we would work with them to do capacity building so that they could get the financial piece in order to then be able to use their passions and talents on the kind of programmatic side. So at Deed also, to the extent we have capacity to assist those nonprofits, we want to do it because ultimately the nonprofits play an important role in the landscape. I mean, they account for significant employment in the state, but also they are providing services that are critical in our communities. And so that's where we're trying to strike that balance between oversight and assistance. And then when it comes to actually measuring lives changed or people assisted, you know, that's, of course, important, and that's partly where the site visits come in to make sure that something is happening. But I'll tell you also that both from our perspective at the state agency and also throughout philanthropy, it is tricky to know what is it that caused someone's life to be meaningfully impacted or not. If you're talking about nutrition, maybe it's clear, like, was food provided? But if you're talking about employment, we have other ways of measuring that. Did a person get a degree? Did they complete the course? Are they ultimately employed? Mm-hmm. But whether it was clearly because of this intervention or because they had a parent that, you know, really help them move along that spectrum, those things are somewhat hard to determine, but we want to make sure at least that the things that the grantees said they would do in the grant contract are in fact being done.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I won't, it's a long, much broader conversation, so I won't ask anymore. So thank you for coming in, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had a lot of discussion this morning about paperwork, but how much of the paperwork is really completing online forms where you would have an ability to have the system check to make sure that fields are completed before an application is complete, for example. And the form is just something that gets printed out at the end once all of the data has been entered. So what I'm really getting at is, to what degree are we able to enforce the requirements through the system?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll give a brief answer, and I might turn to my colleague that leads more of the grant-making work. You're right that paperwork probably is a shorthand for lots of digital forms these days, and you'll find them all on our website. We do rely heavily on the standardized features of this process established by the Office of Grants Management, who's a great partner to us. I think at the same time we're trying to be accessible, so if there's an organization that for some reason isn't comfortable or isn't able to do it electronically, we want to give them the paper option as well. I think one of the topics you touched on in the past also was Transparency Minnesota. That's a website where you can look up a grantee and see who are the other agencies that may have received funds from them. And then that's part of our checklist process, is if you see that we're working with an entity that has received funds from another agency, you then reach out to them and find out was the performance satisfactory from your point of view. But Deputy Commissioner, anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner, Madam Chair, Representative Elkins. I think the other piece, which is we are transitioning our grants management system at the for the better. We do work with paper quite a bit, and I think that it allows us to really kind of work with our grantee back and forth on what they are submitting. So there is a little bit of reliance on paperwork. But we also have what's called Workforce One, which is our database where we kind of collect information around what is occurring with an individual and our CRM, for example. And we utilize that tool to understand their enrollment numbers. We also understand, you know, what funding individuals are receiving. And we use the information that we collect in that system in our, when we do work with our grantees, to monitor how they're delivering services, but where they are in the process of delivering the services. So we'll know at, you know, a moment's time how many people are enrolled in a particular program. if you know, at any given time. So when we, and that's required by, actually, it's in legislation that all grantees use our Workforce One system, so that we can document their services that they're delivering.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, please proceed, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on to the grant review function, and we have touched on some of this in the discussion that has already occurred. But as you can see, once the RFP closes, lead staff then review the submissions to just ensure, first of all, that they meet the minimum requirements, such as did they follow the rules of the application, staying within the page limit, have they included a budget document, and so forth. Then we have grant review panels that review and score the proposals. And then recommendations are submitted up to me for review and approval, and I get to have the final authority over those award decisions. And I will say that because we have a thorough process, because I get a memo that outlines all of the steps that were followed in the process, I do a final check, and sometimes I'll ask questions, but to a significant degree am pleased with the recommendations that come to me. And then that's where we I would sign off, and we would then move on to the next step. Community reviewers are a part of that last step that we talked about on the preceding slide. We have a goal that all grant review panels consist of approximately one quarter of people who are non-deed staff. And we believe that community reviewers make for a more inclusive process and better funding decisions. I've said in other venues that deed staff are very talented, and we are also located all across the state, but this is another way that we can get perspectives from a variety of backgrounds and from a variety of communities when it comes to deciding who receives the funds that are available to us. So when opportunities arise, we put out an application for community reviewers, and the applicants are asked about their qualifications and experience related to the subject matter of the RFP. And then those reviewers dedicate about 20 to 40 hours over the course of 2 to 3 weeks to review and score grant proposals. I believe it's the case that one reviewer doesn't look at the whole slew of applicants. I mean, depending on how big of a program it is. Rather, let's say you have 100 applications. One reviewer might see 10 of them, and another might see another 10. And there will be some overlap in those. And so then you line up the average scores so that you can see where the applicants shake out.
Thank you. Commissioner, do community reviewers receive compensation?
Madam Chair, Devin Bowdry, Government Relations Director at DEED. We received some money from the foundation to award stipends. They were in the amount of about $100. I don't know if we still have funding left, maybe a little bit. Little bit of funding, but that we're actually funded by the legislature to provide, no.
Thank you. And what was the foundation that provided the stipends?
I'll have to get back to you on that, Representative.
That's fine. Just curious. Thank you. Great. Thank you very much for explaining that process. Do you have more comments on that? Or
just the one last bullet, Madam Chair, if I may, is that the community reviewers, as well as the deed staff, also have to submit a signed conflict of interest form before receiving any grant proposals to review to, again, indicate that they don't have an affiliation that would cause them not to be objective. Okay. So now the pre-award risk assessment. First, we check with unemployment insurance to ensure that the employer itself, the applicant, is up to date with no outstanding debts related to unemployment insurance. Then we do the transparency check on MMB's website, as I mentioned, to see if a grantee has worked with other agencies and ensure that no contract termination occurred. The Department of Administration has a site for suspended or debarred vendors. I think we also look at the system of award management on the federal level to see if there's any similar debarment. Verification of tax exclusions. Check the Secretary of State website to ensure that they are up to date there. Review the risk assessment form that has information, including the financials that we talked about. So here we get into the ratio sheet, the asset test, which I think is current assets minus inventories over current liabilities. I might be wrong about that. Debt to equity ratio sheet, And then review by our deed finance director to ascertain the risk level, depending on where they land on those ratios. And also, I'm not sure if it says it here, but we try to assess the quality of their financial management system. I mean, just having a good system in place that is not paper for your finances is critical. One thing that's really important to us is being able to segregate sources and uses, including staff time assigned to any given grant. If all the money just goes into one big bucket, that's not good. You want to be able to ensure that a staffer who's spending 10% of their time on a given grant is then charging it back to that particular source. And this, again, takes me back to my days at a nonprofit when we had multiple sources, some governmental, some from philanthropy. And in each case, there were strings attached, and so you needed to make sure you were following those.
Great. I'll interrupt you for just a second, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I may have my question. Maybe that was a different presentation. My question was, so this pre-award risk assessment, and I think many of these were put into place in 2023 in last term, which is great. And I think it's correct that this applies to direct appropriations and additional competitive grants, sort of anytime money's going out the door, whether we direct it or competitive. And again, big fan of competitive grants. We should be shifting that way. But can you just confirm that this applies either way?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, correct.
Okay, good, thank you.
Thank you, please proceed. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, just really quickly. So you were talking about making sure that the money is not in one big general fund. So do you actually review their chart of accounts?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, basically. And we review, the depth that we go into, I guess, depends on circumstances, but we certainly, and we'll get into this in a subsequent slide too, only reimburse if they can provide the receipts, so to speak, for the expenditures that they're claiming. Now, we have some authority to do cash advance, but even then they have to provide lots of documentation. And yes, we can go as deep into the financials as we need to, is my understanding. Deputy Commissioner, would you add anything to that?
Yes, thanks, Commissioner, Madam Chair, Representative. We do have a process that when we look at the financials, and if we, and the Commissioner kind of alluded to it, we will look and see if a grantee, how we deem them to be fiscally ready to take on a grant. And we will categorize them as in priorities in terms of high, medium, and low level. And what we generally will do in the first quarter or the first two quarters of the grant year is actually go out and evaluate their systems. So we'll look at their ledgers, we'll look at their policies and procedures. And this is to assist that organization, is to see if there may be some challenges so that we can handle early and often. And any organization that's new to the portfolio, we also take that we'll have that same strategy of going out and reviewing their systems early enough so that because they are new to our agency, I won't tell you they're new overall, but new to our portfolio. So those are some of the steps that do occur early before you're too far down the road into the grant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I know we don't do that at the legislature. We don't do site visits to look at their, you know, whatever computer system they're using, whether it's Denari or, you know, Excel, you know, whatever it is, QuickBooks, and to actually look at their chart of accounts to make sure they have all of those appropriations or all those, the revenue streams separated out. So another reason why we probably shouldn't be doing directed appropriations here at the legislature, because I don't think anybody's going to want to go out to a site visit and go, let me see your systems and all of that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yes, well, I'm glad to hear you are doing that work, Commissioner. So please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think maybe just the last bullet that I hadn't mentioned, but if that set of evaluations would yield a recommendation that they be named as high risk, then we have the opportunity to take additional measures, some of which we've touched on.
Thank you. I did have a question regarding that. So is there any level of the risk assessment where you deem it too high risk, or will you always just try to work with people if they come back as high risk?
I believe we, Madam Chair, I believe we have, in some cases, not gotten to a contract because we weren't satisfied with these items. Deputy Commissioner?
I would Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'd agree with that. We have had instances where they were just, agency may have been too much of a high risk that we did not proceed with an award. We do take the steps as much as we can to make sure to give them to opportunity to cure a situation if they can. But at a certain point, then we have to move on. But just be, and we do this again, both in these assessment, both in competitive and direct appropriations. So we don't treat either differently in our strategy.
Thank you. One follow-up for me. So then when you deem someone too high risk so that you don't proceed with a contract, is that flagged by you in the Transparency Minnesota system so other agencies are also aware of that?
Madam Chair, that's something I have to go back and check with my team on that. We can definitely respond.
Great. Later. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I may just add, as we're having this conversation now, I'm remembering we've had cases where nonprofits have simply said, well, thanks for naming us as a potential grantee, but we will, you know, respectfully decline to go to contract because we can't really do it. So that's, I guess, an example of the system working. This also is where we sometimes get inquiries from the other direction saying, why, Deed, are you making it such a pain to do business
exactly.
with you? And we really don't want to ever unnecessarily impede the process of getting to a contract because those services really are important in community, but it's just always the balancing act.
Thank you. All right. Next slide.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So moving on, next to steps to completing an executed grant agreement. So they submit the risk assessment worksheet, and this is used to determine if we need to place any special conditions, as just referenced. And this is before any dollars flow. And if we're in a good place, the grantee will receive a notice via email that they've been approved for an award, and they also receive an official paper award letter. Although maybe that goes electronically too, but I get to see the letters and sign them. And then grantee registers as a vendor with the state. They submit an updated work plan to reflect the final award amount if it's different than what was requested, because sometimes if you apply for $250,000, but we approve a set of grantees that would go beyond the amount we have available, we'll say, well, we'll approve you for $200,000. And can you still work with that? In some cases, the nonprofit will say, actually, no. Below a certain level, it's not worthwhile for them to proceed. But in most cases, they do agree to work at that smaller level. And then the grantee receives and signs a finalized grant agreement and provides a copy via email to Deed. And I'll also identify that in this process of the work plan, this is somewhere that we also sometimes can be perceived as an impediment, but we are working hard to make sure that what the nonprofit says they're going to do in much more detailed terms aligns with either what was in the RFP and the legislation that shaped the RFP or what was in the legislatively directed appropriation, because sometimes there will be a difference of interpretation. You might perceive the earmark one way, the nonprofit might perceive it another way. And if the nonprofit ultimately is proposing activities that we don't think aligns, then we will say, you got to revise this. And sometimes that can involve multiple volleys back and forth. And sometimes we don't get to a satisfactory conclusion if we don't think we can verify that they're doing what the law says. And then they get mad at us. On to grant agreements. So we negotiate this with the grantees. The agreement covers a wide range of terms and responsibilities. We don't make payments until a grant agreement is signed by all parties. And work that a grantee does prior to a grant agreement being in place is not reimbursable. Little typo there, sorry for that. And I'm not sure if we have this in subsequent slides, but the structure of our contract, the grant agreement, substantially follows the kind of template from Office of Grants Management.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, this is just a quick question here. You work through a whole host of grants. Is there a certain What is the threshold for the amount of money that a grantee would have to receive to go through your full process here? Is there a threshold where they don't go through this rigorous process?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not aware that there's a threshold where they wouldn't go through the pre-award risk assessment, but there are gradations when it comes to monitoring. And with respect to whether they're new to our portfolio, as the Deputy Commissioner said. So everyone has to go through the basics, but then if you are new to our portfolio, you get a little more attention. If the grant is of a certain size, we're required to do, or our policy is to do, a little bit more monitoring.
Thank you. Please proceed with the next slide.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So next slide here, reimbursement. So grant payments are processed on a reimbursement basis, meaning the nonprofit does the work and then submits evidence that they did the work to us, and then we send money to their account afterward. In limited circumstances, we are authorized to do cash advances. But even then, again, lots of validation and verification is required. It's simply a matter of timing. And you'll hear in the nonprofit sector sometimes concerns about how long it takes the process of providing us the receipts, us reviewing, validating, et cetera, and then telling our fiscal department to send the dollars. That is a certain delay, and the nonprofit has to have the cash flow, the liquid assets, to survive during that period of time. And again, we don't want that to take any longer than it needs to, and we don't have a perfect record of getting everything processed quickly. But we're trying to strike the balance as best we can.
Commissioner, if I might interrupt. So with other agencies, there seems to be different criteria for when they can stop payment. And is there a certain criteria that DEED uses to decide you're going to stop payment to a grantee?
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I would look to my colleague in just a moment. I mean, I believe the grant agreement, boilerplate language, has quite expansive powers for us to terminate a contract under a wide range of circumstances. So I think our powers are extensive there, but Deputy Commissioner, what would you add?
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Madam Chair, it depends, to give you the law school kind of argument there, but there could be some scenarios where, as I mentioned earlier, that grantees are required to submit information into what we call Workforce One, which is our database, so that we can cross-check to make sure that we see that the agency is delivering services. If we start to see an ongoing process where over a course of time that an agency is not submitting information in the Workforce One, we will call the question as to what is occurring and work with that grantee. In addition, we will see if they're not submitting their proper paperwork, so their progress reports on a timely manner with their their requests for payment. So those will be some incidents, but it depends on the scenario, but those are kind of the bigger ones, and not submitting paperwork on a timely manner, and also not inputting data into Workforce One for us.
Perfect. And you don't have to know it off the top of your head, but it would be great to know how many instances you've stopped payments in the last year or two, just to understand that. And it would also be great to see a copy of that boilerplate contract language about your authority to stop payments. So if you could just have that sent over, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So carrying on through the slides, at the bottom there you can see we review each request for reimbursement against the approved grant budget, expenditures to date, and the latest grant progress report before approving payment. I think I would add also, partly in relation to the last conversation there, that this is where we get into the judgment calls of grants management, because we don't default automatically to every infraction being an automatic disqualification and stopping payment. We know that in a lot of cases the services being provided are critical to community, or we wouldn't be in a grant agreement in the first place, and we have to weigh, will stopping payment which is of course important to protect taxpayer funds, does that scale of impact outweigh the interruption of services?
Great. If you don't mind, Representative Verrick has a question.
Thank you. So you had said that you are looking for receipts before you send reimbursement. Do you mean like literal receipts, or do you mean like reports about receipts? As in, you know, I used to do auditing, so I'm like, is it, you know, the receipt from when they purchased a piece of equipment? Is it a payroll report? Like, what exactly do you mean by the word receipts?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll again turn to my colleague, and I'm not seeing those, but I know from when I was on the side of submitting them, it was both of those things. It was that mix of things, because yes, if you bought a thing, a widget, then you needed to show that you had done so and provide evidence for it, or a plane ticket to go to a training, sure, et cetera. But also on the staffing side, to show the timesheet that says, what's your salary rate? And I spent 2 hours doing this, and that's allowable within this particular funding source, et cetera. So those are the kinds of things that I recall we sent in and that I believe now we review on the deed side.
Yeah. Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. For workforce development grants, specifically, we look, it's our reimbursement document that all our agencies sign off and certify to that these are the expenditures. And now you'll see in the slide, as we move through the process, you'll start to hear about monitoring. And then when we go out and do our monitoring, that is when we kind of do a cross-check of those receipts against our reimbursement forms. That's very specific to workforce development and how we approach it. Because as you can imagine, for every pencil purchased and for every, you know, for all staffing, if we had a receipt, we would never get payments out for, you know, 300 plus grantees that we work with on a monthly basis. So it's a certifying component that each executive director or their designated staff sign off when they submit that reimbursement. But then we go back and then we validate it during our monitoring, which we're going to go into that in a second.
Thank you.
That great. Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on that piece regarding the reimbursement process and the delay between when reports of services being rendered have been offered to you and then you go through your process to determine whether or not to release the funds. When we talk about it having an impact upon the community, it occurs to me that there's less of a danger of that if a higher percentage of the funding for that organization is coming from philanthropic private sources and they don't have to rely so much upon getting prompt reimbursements from the state. In your experience, because we've seen a broad range of percentages of how much of an organization's budget comes from state grants as opposed to private philanthropy, Is there an average or a trend, or what are you seeing amongst the organizations that you're working with?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, thanks for the question. And again, I'll refer to my colleague and invite him to weigh in on this since he probably sees it a little bit more closely. I will say from the perspective of one nonprofit executive director, when that's what I was, our share of governmental sources versus non varied a lot depending on just the year that we were in, because of course during COVID we had small business relief grants and child care emergency grants, et cetera. And so you would have seen that percentage kind of balloon temporarily. But fortunately I was at a nonprofit which happened to be a foundation which had an endowment, et cetera, which gives you a lot of financial security, which many nonprofits don't have the benefit of. And I think the philanthropic community does try to assist there in providing somewhat more flexible resources. We often say that government money is some of the hardest money to work with because we need to have these strings because, you know, all the taxpayers are our board of directors, so to speak. So it's beneficial, to be sure, if a nonprofit has a variety of sources, some of which are more flexible than others. But in terms of averages of governmental versus non, I don't know if the Deputy Commissioner might have a view on that.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have an actual percentage on that, but I would just echo the point that the Commissioner says that we actually really encourage our grantees to have flexible dollars, and for the exact reason that you just highlighted. If there's a delay in payment, that they have resources that they can go to cover their gap during the time while they're waiting for reimbursement.
Thank you. Please proceed. We again try and step it up here, so we'll try to let you proceed and finish your presentation.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and we appreciate all the good conversation. So, Office of Grants Management Policy requires grantees to submit written progress reports at least annually. At DEED, we choose to have them quarterly. So, OGM's requirements are kind of the baseline, and then we have room to adjust according to our needs. The progress report summarizes activities and outcomes for a given period with a narrative, statistical and financial elements, et cetera, and can include information on outcomes, activities, lessons learned and financial information, et cetera. And I'll say, too, that this is an area where there's an ongoing discussion in the philanthropic community about what's the best kind of evaluation report, because nonprofits spend a lot of time producing them, and then you kind of wonder who's reading them, and would it actually be more beneficial to have a conversation, or can you have both? Because, you know, there's an incentive on the part of the grantee to just say, everything's great, everything worked out beautifully, but you want to have a candid enough relationship where you can reveal that, well, we have some difficulties in this way, and hopefully if you have sort of a good faith relationship, you can reveal that in a constructive way as opposed to getting in trouble and being kicked out for the future, because oftentimes the grantee wants to maintain an ongoing relationship for future opportunities. On to monitoring, lots of words here, but we'll try to just highlight some of the key ones. So we do at least one visit before final payment on all grants over $50,000. So here we get into those gradations, Representative Schultz, and we do annual monitoring visits on grants of over $250,000. The purpose is to ensure progress against the goals and address any problems or issues before the end of the period. An effective visit can cover topics including but not limited to compliance, challenges faced, et cetera. And I want to acknowledge, I believe all of these are prearranged monitoring visits. Unlike with in the childcare space, I don't believe we do the unannounced drop-in type, or I think the vice chair of the committee mentioned that the Board of Cosmetology does that in certain cases, but ours are of the monitoring variety where we are you know, arranging it ahead of time so that folks can get their ducks in a row and have their paperwork present if that's what's needed to show that they're on track.
And just to clarify, those are in-person monitoring visits, or they're done by Teams or some other technical assistance?
Madam Chair, I believe it's a mix, and I would invite the Deputy Commissioner to comment.
Thanks, Commissioner and Madam Chair. Just kind of tagging on to what the Commissioner says is that we actually have a monitoring guide that we produce for each of our programs, and those are sent out 30 days prior to our monitoring visit. So as the Commissioner mentioned, this gives the grantee the opportunity to get the information that they need. So when the team, and it's usually we have a monitoring team for workforce development, and it would be either, it could be one person or it could be a couple people depending on the scope of their review. But when they're on site, that they do actually look at the paperwork. Now they may do some preliminary work in advance and ask the agency to submit, you know, ledgers or something like that in advance so the team can look at that. But they do have, they do end up on site for between the 50 and over the 250, sorry, 250 amount on an annual basis. They do on site reviews.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, to proceed, you can see in the second to last bullet, we do a financial reconciliation at least once before the final payment is made, which involves looking at the request for payment, checking out that supporting documentation, et cetera, which is some of what we discussed already. And the final bullet refers, I guess, to the risk assessment again, is if we had identified them as high risk, we would do a monitoring visit within the first two quarters of the grant agreement. When it comes to closeout, grantees must submit their final payment request within 20 days. And in addition to the final payment request, they have to submit a final report on outcomes. which summarizes activities and what was accomplished over the grant period. We then review the request and the report and do a closeout evaluation in terms of whether objectives were met, and then successful grantees receive a closeout notice confirming completion and that all documents will be placed in the grant file. And it's the policy of the state to consider a grant applications or a grant applicant's past performance before awarding subsequent grants to them.
And Commissioner, if I may, if the grant closeout evaluation is not meeting standards, do you still make the final grant payment?
Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. In general, it depends on what Madam Chair.
That's fine.
Representatives. In general, we will, but it depends on what the circumstance may be. If it's something where we're unable to verify an expenditure or if we see any irregularity, then we will convene with our partner or the agency to identify what the challenge is and then make a determination at that point. But I don't, off the top of my head, recall too many instances where I've seen that happen, where we went pay someone on a closeout.
Thank you. I find it concerning. I feel like the point of these closeout evaluations is to make sure, especially if this is the only time you're reviewing the financials, as at the end of the period, that it's important that if things aren't buttoned up, that you would withhold payment until it's fixed. So I encourage you to, you know, consider that. Thank you. Oh, Representative Rarick.
Just really quickly, so is all this information public data? And then secondly, how many staff members do you have to monitor all of this grant activity? And it's like almost 400, it was actually over $400 million.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, in terms of it being public data, I believe what's on Transparency Minnesota now is simply what agencies a given nonprofit may have received funds from. I don't believe that the contents of the evaluation materials are available there, and I'm not sure if that's changing. So you wouldn't get the inside scoop necessarily on we were disappointed with the performance related to X, Y, and Z, which also relates, Madam Chair, to your comment about is the final review just a kind of a pro forma rubber stamp process? And I would say no. If we see that we don't have all the necessary paperwork, et cetera, then we wouldn't make the final payment. But if it's a matter of, well, everybody did what they promised to do and it just wasn't quite as effective of an intervention in the world, that's different. We wouldn't necessarily hold that against them. So again, that's kind of where the judgment call comes into place. And then your final question about the number of staff reviewing it, I don't know quite how to answer that here at the desk, because we would need to figure out how much time. I mean, you have some people that are dedicated specifically to the grants management, and then you have other people in our administrative and financial services that play a part in it. But Deputy Commissioner, might you be able to share just a little bit about your staffing and who does what within your division?
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner and Madam Chair, members of the committee. It goes through a number of iterations when we get a reimbursement. As I mentioned, there's a staff member who's called a grant coordinator who will review that reimbursement request. And again, going back, they'll also go and look at the Workforce One system to evaluate if they're seeing a progression of work that's occurring. There's a little bit of a, when you look at that reimbursement request, does it really match the amount that they're asking for where they are in terms of the grant and meeting their goals? So we know, for instance, there may be requests for some startup activities, and we may not see actually a high number of enrollments the first couple of months because they're starting up that grant. But if we, for instance, see they're requesting 50% of their dollars in that first quarter, and we don't, like, we'll start to ask the questions, and we're not seeing that they're enrolling information or putting information into Workforce One. So that team will start that process. Then you'll get, and then they'll, so there's already, before monitoring starts, there is a little bit of a scrutiny of what's being requested. Then you'll get to the monitoring team, which is, I'll have to go back and look at the numbers, but it's grown over the last couple of years. And they'll go out and do the on-site. And then, as the commissioner had mentioned as well, is that through our fiscal team, there's another group of folks that are not tied to workforce development that is looking at any reimbursement. So the number of people that are looking at a reimbursement, there's it goes through quite a bit of a process. So we'd have to, if you want actual numbers, we can come back to you with that.
Representative Rick.
Thank you, that's helpful. You know, Representative Schultz had talked about the Office of Inspector General within DHS. It's, they had mentioned to us that they have about 400, and I don't know how many folks are at DEED, and I came to visit you, and Deputy Commissioner, I know I met you then with my niece, and just kind of wandered through the building with her and talking to you, to folks. How many people are at DEED in total, just so we have a sense as to how big, because it's $431 million that flows through, according to your slide.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative. Roughly 1,500 at DEED in total.
Great, thank you. All right, so I think we're at the end, but maybe you have a few more closing comments.
I wish I did, Madam Chair, but no, that is the end of the presentation.
Fantastic. Well, we really appreciate you coming. Appreciate the work and the rigorous process you seem to have in place, and I look forward to some follow-up in the future. There's a whole nother area I'd like to learn more about. It's how you determine eligibility for some of the other programs, not necessarily the grant programs. So perhaps we could have you back at a different time to talk about sort of UI and some of the COVID programs and how that went and how any continued follow-up you have on that, because I think there is some concern about eligibility issues across state agencies that, you know, our committee would like to take a look at. So perhaps we can do that at a different time. Thank you very much. Members, we are adjourned.